Hey everyone, what's going on? Welcome to a brand new edition of the Sam Bissell Podcast on the Ambiguous Podcast Solutions. And right now I'm going to be bringing you the latest and greatest going on around the world of Hollywood. Hope everyone is having a wonderful week so far. We're almost to the weekend. We're almost to the end of March, so hopefully everyone is looking forward to that. A lot of stuff that I want to talk about on the podcast today. There's a lot of news that has been coming out over the first half of the week. I'm going to be getting into some Cannes Film Festival news in regards to some major players that could be coming out of the film festival. Also, for one of those potential films, they also have a release date for their specific date for when they're actually going to be hitting everyone to see the film. Also going to be getting into some major Marvel news in terms of some casting, some old members coming back, some new blood coming into the MCU. I'm also going to be getting into a bunch or a select few trending trailers that have come out so far over the last couple of days. But the first few things that I actually want to talk about on the podcast today as we kick off is going into the TV corner of the podcast and going over some reviews and some things that I saw over the last couple days that I want to talk about. And the first thing actually happened over the weekend, and that was actually the season 4 premiere of the hit HBO show Succession. And one of the great things about HBO is that basically they kind of have this format down, especially owning the Sunday night slot and basically transitioning from one hit show to the next. We're basically this year so far, they've gone from The Last of Us, which has become this phenomenon. It was a huge smash and success for the company, for HBO, and they basically go from what's going to be one of their big shows moving forward into the future to kind of the closing chapter of one of their biggest hits over the last maybe five, six years or so, and that is Succession, which of course stars Brian Cox, Jeremy Strong, Kieran Culkin, Sarah Snook, Alan Cummings. There's a whole bunch of people that have been a part of this amazing, amazing cast, and the first three seasons have just been some exceptional television. From the writing, the direction, the characters, the acting, the set design, production design, it's all been just top-notch, A-plus level quality. And going into this final season, which really, it was speculated that this could maybe be the final season of Succession. We didn't know if we would get at least one or two more seasons of the show. It was confirmed by their showrunner, Jesse Armstrong, that season 4 was going to be the final season. So starting this past Sunday was the beginning of the end for Succession, kind of going out on its own accord by the creators. Not that the ratings had anything to do with it. Creatively, it was getting kind of dated and wasn't as exciting as it used to be. This is the creators wanted to go out on their own. So it's pretty exciting to see what these final 10 episodes are going to equate to, now 9, now that the premiere has come and gone. And for the season 4 premiere of Succession, which is titled The Munsters, I really enjoyed what I got in this first outing in the final season. I think it sets everything up beautifully for what we're going to get in the rest of this season leading into the final 9 episodes. And I think it also did a great job of kind of continuing some things that were left over in the season 3 finale, which was a phenomenal episode of the show, probably top tier in the show, even within the HBO kind of line of episodes that have come out from exceptional shows. It's up there, and just being able to deliver on twists and turns and stories that you didn't really kind of see coming. And so kind of delivering on that with this premiere, I thought it did a great job of reestablishing these characters, showcasing where they are in their journeys right now. And I think they did a good job of evolving some of these characters and placing them into some really interesting kind of concepts and scenarios. The banter, the dialogue is witty, it's crisp still. I still felt myself on the edge of my seat when it came to kind of the deal making, the machinations of kind of the world of broadcasting and kind of media marketing. All that kind of fell into place with this episode. You got some cast members that were a part of past seasons that returned to this episode. So you very much felt like this was kind of the full circle moment that we're going to be touching on all these different avenues that we've seen in the first three seasons. And it's all going to kind of come to a head in these last couple of episodes. And I think they did a really good job of establishing that in this episode. I thought Matthew, what some of these guys were able to do in this episode are really, really good. Specifically Matthew McFadden, who plays Tom Wimesgans. I think what he's been able to do over the last probably half of these episodes so far, going back to the back half of season three. He's been, to me, the MVP of the show so far. He has some great lines kind of with Cousin Gray that you expect to see in this show, but there's also, not to get into spoilers or any kind of the big details, but specifically towards the end of the episode, there's a scene between him and Sarah Snook as Shiv and Tom, and they kind of deal with the fallout of what happened with season three, and I think it was just a beautifully well-crafted scene between the direction and also the acting. I think what Matthew McFadden has been delivering so far, and they've been able to really tap into something with this character over the last half of these episodes, that I'm really looking forward to see what they're going to be able to continue to do and showcasing this new dynamic between Tom and Shiv that's really, really interesting. I thought the dynamics and seeing kind of the after effects of season three to season four between Rome, Shiv, and Kendall were really interesting. I love kind of the camaraderie, chemistry between Jeremy Strong, Kieran Culkin, and Sarah Snook was really, really interesting. And then, of course, Brian Cox is doing what he does best as Logan Roy. I mean, he just knows how to deliver, and I think he does a great job of a lot of the quieter moments in this episode, the scenes that he's not the bombastic, F-off, dialogue-heavy stuff or one-liner clips that we know Logan Roy to do. It was a lot more of the quieter scenes in this episode that really stood out when it came to Logan Roy and really, really what he's dealing with and what he's feeling as we kick off this final season. So I really enjoyed everything we got in this season four premiere. And I know some people thought that it didn't really do a whole lot of setting up the story or maybe furthering anything along from what happened in the past few seasons. But I think, again, what premieres always do, and HBO is just notorious for this, whether it's the company or whether it's the creators, and because they know how many episodes they have, it's a tone setter. I've said it throughout a lot of these episodes and throughout a lot of premieres for a lot of shows. You set what's going to happen, and I think a lot of the story building blocks that are set in this premiere are going to carry through for the final nine episodes, and it's all just going to be amazing. And from all the interviews that I've heard with a lot of the cast and crew, Jesse Armstrong, the showrunners, writers, I should say, it sounds like we're going to be delivered something awesome with this final season. And so I'm really excited about it. And I think the season four premiere was a great way to continue that and set forth what is going to be hopefully a fantastic finish for this exceptional, incredible show of Succession. And then to move on to the second review that I wanted to do, it is the non-spoiler review for season 3, episode 5 of The Mandalorian, which of course came out today on Wednesday. It is chapter 21, which is titled The Pirate. And again, this is going to be a non-spoiler review and into what I thought about the episode, not getting into any of the details about the episode itself. And I thought there were actually some really good surprises in this one, especially if you're a big Star Wars fan within the lexicon of what Dave Filoni does within Rebels and Clone Wars and a lot of the stuff that you would suspect that you know they do, especially with Book of Boba Fett, the first two seasons of The Mandalorian. I think Star Wars fans in general will be satisfied with this episode. There's some cool Easter eggs and cameos that go on. But again, I'm not going to get into any of the specifics. I want you to watch the episode and experience it for yourself to find out what happens. But just in overall terms, what I thought of this episode, I thought this was the best episode of the season by far. I really enjoyed the first four episodes, but to me, episode five felt like kind of a little semi-culmination of everything we've kind of gone through in this season so far. It kind of touches back on certain storylines that we were introduced in the first episode, in the third episode, in the fourth episode, and it kind of brings itself to a head while also setting up different storylines to come in the back half of the season, even though we're in the back half right now with episode five. We only have three more episodes to go, which is, again, kind of crazy to think about, since it felt like we just started this season. But nonetheless, we have three more episodes to go. But while it seems like it's setting up the ending of this season and different storylines that are opening up and potentially more seasons for Mandalorian down the line, it's also kind of setting up, I feel like, more of what we're going to be exploring with this overall world that we have been kind of teased about, this kind of Filoni-Favreau universe where things like Book of Boba Fett, Ahsoka, Skeleton Crew are all kind of getting, are going to be connected in some kind of a way to leading up to this major big event in potential years to come. And I feel like this episode did a lot of that heavy lifting and drove that story moving forward. But a lot of this season has been really kind of diving into different areas of the Star Wars universe and different characters that were kind of side characters, that it was very much more about Mando's journey. Whereas I feel like so far with season three, we're still on a Mando's journey, but we're taking more time to turn attention to some of these other side characters like a Bo-Katan and some of the other ones that we get in this episode, that I was really kind of happy to see that. And I think it's great to kind of see more about the New Republic. And even though we have The Force Awakens, The Last Jedi, and The Rise of Skywalker, I feel like those, that sequel trilogy didn't do enough to kind of flesh out this universe post episode six. And this season so far, to me, has done a great job of really establishing what the New Republic is like and what everything is like post-Empire. And I really am enjoying what Favreau and Filoni have been doing so far in the scripts for this one. I know some people think that it's been a lot of stalling on the story and not a lot has been kind of progressing, but I like the way that they've been establishing everything, and now it seems like we're moving ahead with these final three episodes where I think a lot of different questions are going to kind of be coming up and kind of things that are posed that can be speculated towards what we're going to be getting in these final three episodes of season three. Peter Ramsey was the director of this episode. It's his first time directing in the Star Wars universe, first time directing on The Mandalorian, and it's the first thing that I've seen him do since he was a co-director on Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and of course that is one of the great comic book films of all time, arguably the best Spider-Man film of all time, one of the great animated films of the last decade. It's an amazing story. And so you see him go from animation to live action, and I really enjoy what he did with this episode. I think he kept the core of what we know for The Mandalorian to be. He added his own little flavors in there. I thought the action was done really well in this episode. We get some cool battle sequences, in a way, fighter sequences that are really kind of cool as well. So he made a really good stamp and impression on this episode as well. Again, kind of speaking about showcasing different characters and highlighting some of the more supporting characters, I liked seeing what Carl Weathers did in this episode, and I feel like he hasn't really gotten to do that. Even though we saw him in the premiere episode, seeing what he did in this episode, I really hadn't seen that maybe since season one, and I know he had an episode in season two, but really you got to focus a lot on him in this episode as well. So I just think the story building in this one, not necessarily the world building, but the story building, progressing the story in different avenues, opening up different mysteries, closing out certain storylines we've been following since episode one of this season, but opening up new avenues that I think are going to be very interesting to tell in these final three seasons are some of the best highlights for me in this episode, and kind of brought the best of everything we've seen so far in this entire season of The Mandalorian. So again, I really enjoyed it. I had a blast with it. It's my favorite episode of the season so far, but we still have three episodes for me to maybe be dissuaded to maybe thinking one of those three might be my favorites in the season, or maybe an overall Mandalorian, like I saw, of course, with season two, the finale. So maybe we're going to get more of that down the road, but chapter 21, The Pirate, was a great addition and continuation of the story in season three so far. What did you guys think about the fifth episode of season three of The Mandalorian? Also, what did you think about the season four premiere of Succession? Is there one that you like more than the other? Which one are you enjoying more right now, even though Succession just started? Are you a bigger fan of Succession? Are you a bigger fan of Mandalorian? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. I'd love to know what you guys think about each of these shows and which episode you might have enjoyed, or maybe you enjoyed both. You can still enjoy a bunch of stuff equally and not just one over the other. All right, moving on now to some movie news, some big movie news that has come out over the last couple of days. And I'm going to start out with a new project that just got greenlit over at the Walt Disney Studios. And one of the big things that is coming out of Disney Studios nowadays, of course, is the live-action remakes of their hit classic animated films. Of course, Aladdin was a billion-dollar hit. The Lion King was a billion-dollar hit. You had Beauty and the Beast was a huge gargantuan hit. So was Cinderella. All these films that are kind of the ethos of Disney and are you can't think of these things without thinking of Disney at the same exact time, and are etched in their history and are just ingrained into parents and kids. And we have more of them coming down the pipeline. We have Little Mermaid this year. We have Snow White coming out next year. We have a sequel slash prequel to The Lion King coming out next year as well from Barry Jenkins called Mufasa. So this is very much something that is not stopping for the Disney machine right now. And this is very much kind of its own little, I guess you could say, kind of genre within the Disney company right now, where you are expanding and also retelling these classic stories from these classic animated films that everyone just adores to pieces. And it seems like Disney has found a new one to adapt to the live action lexicon, and that is one of their more kind of underrated hits that kind of goes unnoticed a little bit, and that is The Aristocats. And they now have a director for this film, and when you know the name, it just makes perfect sense. And that is the one and only Questlove is going to be making his feature film debut with Walt Disney's The Aristocats. He, of course, if you know Questlove, if you know him from being a part of The Roots, which is a part of the band for Jimmy Fallon on his late night show, but over the last couple of years he has expanded into really kind of becoming and hopes to become a predominant director in this business. And he did that right away with his directorial debut with the documentary that became an Academy Award winner 2 years ago now in Summer of Soul. And that was a really amazing documentary, and it fit, of course, with Questlove being somebody who, of course, is from the music background, is African American, and wanted to kind of tell the story that no one really kind of focused on. And I think he did a great job of doing that. And to see him move into telling more of these stories now is exciting. And to kind of give this project to him for the first time, I think it is a smart move. And I think it's one that showcases that Disney wants to stay in the Questlove business, but that they have confidence in him. And while it's not The Little Mermaid or The Lion King, it's still a property that is a part of this booming genre for Disney right now that is a big moneymaker. And they're trusting a first time, or really a young director with his first major feature film and his first feature ever, to be this major film in the vault of Disney. And when looking at it, I think this is a smart move. Again, I think because The Aristocats deals, if you don't know the story from the animated film, it very much deals in kind of the jazz world per se. It's about these cats that are very much very, very rare and very wealthy, and there's a butler who tries to take them away, and then it's kind of the journey of these kind of cats going back home. And on the way, they meet this kind of outsider, and they see kind of the world around them, and it very much deals in jazz music. And I think having all that to work with for Questlove is perfect for him. And I think it's also going to be a challenge, because this is going to be something that is very much going to be live action and CGI. It's going to be kind of that hybrid. And how are they going to make the cats? Are they going to be the way that we've seen The Lion King animals or Jungle Book? Are they going to be more realistic? Are they going to be kind of a little bit more CGI like, where you can see the emotions on some of the animals' faces? And then I'm curious to see how Questlove is going to be able to handle that. But I think he is the right person to go to. The bigger question to me when it comes to the Aristocats coming to live action that kind of gets my gears going a little bit and thinks about it a bit more. It was funny, before this was announced, I was having this talk with somebody that I know from work, and we were having the conversation of what else is there for Disney to take out of the live action or the classic animation vault and bring it to live action that people would recognize. Because I think when you look at the ones that are huge successes, Aladdin, Lion King, Cinderella, you look at Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, even though it hasn't come out yet, I still think that's going to be a big hit. You, of course, look at Snow White next year. That one I'm very curious about, but Snow White is a big, big Disney princess and is one that everyone knows. So those are ones that make sense to me. But when you get into some of these other live action remakes that don't really deal with specifically sometimes in musical elements, I start to wonder a little bit, is this going to work out? Do people want to see that? I think when you look at films like Dumbo, didn't do really well at the box office. If you look at more of the live action films, Jungle Book was one of the rarities that did work. But if you look at a sequel like Alice Through the Looking Glass, the original film was a $1 billion hit back in 2010, but the sequel to that one didn't do all that well. And then you look at films like Pinocchio, you have Peter Pan and Wendy coming out this year, where that's more of a adaptation of Peter Pan, but it doesn't have any of those musical elements as far as I know. Peter Pan is well known, and some of these characters are well known, but are they well known enough to make a musical, or not a musical, but a live action adaptation of them that people would go to see it? Families would say, you know what, I want to go see that. I want to recapture that magic in a new and different way with my family. That to me comes a little bit of a question of is the route that they're going to go in. When you look at something like a Cinderella, and Cinderella is another unique expectation because it did well for itself to probably get a sequel, especially during those pandemic times in 2021. But is the sequel gonna do well? Would something like A Hunchback of Notre Dame do well? So, and would the Aristocats, or because those are very much kind of the B, C level tiers of characters from the animation lexicon that we're starting to dive into right now. So does it become a question of, does the well in Disney animation to live action retellings dry up? Is that something where it just comes to a point where Disney's just like, you know what, we've dried it up at this point, we'll wait a couple years and then we'll go into the 2010 era where we get into Princess and the Frog, Tangled, maybe Frozen, Moana, Encanto? Is that the kind of the direction that we're heading in right now? So I'm really curious to see where that could go down the line, especially when you're getting into more of these lower tiered adaptations and properties in the animation window. I'm very curious. But when it comes to Questlove, I'm very excited for him. I think he's a right director for this, and I'm excited to see him continue and further his career right now, especially as a director, because I think he did, again, a great job with Summer of Soul. And I think this would be a great opportunity and a great fit for him with this property. So maybe he does turn it into a little bit of a kind of semi-musical film in a way. So we'll see what he does, but I'm really excited to see what he can deliver with that film. What do you guys think about Questlove directing the Aristocats live action adaptation from the animated classic? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. Now moving on to some release dates that I want to get into real quick. The first one, or really the only one that I really want to talk about right now, has to do with the brand new Martin Scorsese film that is set to come out later this year. It's rumored right now to potentially be premiering at the Cannes Film Festival, but potentially after that, if it does debut on the croissant, when is its actual debut going to happen in theaters? And now we do have the official information, as it was reported that Killers of the Flower Moon, the new Martin Scorsese film that stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, Jesse Plemons, will be releasing in limited release on October 6th before going to a wide release in theaters on October 20th. And so, first off, I think that's a great date for Killers of the Flower Moon. I think it fits right in there with the award season friendly release dates during the back half of the year. You want to set yourself up for an award season contention. And of course, with Apple TV Plus, they've, after winning Best Picture a few years ago with Coda and not really having the stake in this year, it seems like they're very much setting themselves up to be in the award season contention field this year with films like Killers of the Flower Moon, with a film like Napoleon from Ridley Scott and starring Joaquin Phoenix. And so for Killers of the Flower Moon, it makes a bunch of sense that they had those two release dates picked out. What all really stands out to me, though, and this was kind of reported a few days prior to the announcement of the Killers of the Flower Moon release date, was that Apple TV Plus is going to be investing more money into their marketing to release their films in theaters rather than streaming first. So basically, some of these streamers like Apple, Amazon, a lot of these tech companies that really want to take themselves seriously in the streaming game, instead of doing what Netflix is doing, like going day and date or foregoing a theater experience or only debuting a few theaters, are making sure right now that potentially they could be having their films debuting on multiple screens for multiple weeks before going to the streaming service. So for Killers of the Flower Moon, we have those two release dates, but we have no idea when this film is going to debut on Apple TV Plus. And so for Apple, it seems like they're seeing the way in the fact that more films could be profitable for them, including when it's a big budgeted film like this from a legendary director like Scorsese, who wants a theatrical release, even though he's working with a streamer on this one. They want to be able to take these films to the theaters, and they're trying to find third-party members on a kind of a film-by-film basis at this point. But for right now, Paramount is going to be distributing this film in theaters right now for them, And so I think that's a really good idea. And I think there could be more profit for this film if it does release in theaters before going to Apple TV Plus. First off, I think it's the fact that people would have to go to the theaters if they really want to see this, instead of waiting however long they would have to wait for Apple for this to be released on their streaming service. And I think it would give people an experience of seeing something like a Martin Scorsese film on the big screen. Because for me, even though I enjoyed seeing Irishman at home, when I went to go see that film on the big screen in a theater, it just enhanced it 10 times fold. And I just really think that having these films in theaters is going to help profitability down the line. And I think this is, this is the correct way of having these films come out in theaters. And I think being able to work alongside these streamers and these theater chains is the right way of going about the business. And I think it gives theaters the opportunity to screen some of these films in theaters, because again, theaters would want these films on their multiplexes. They want them on the big screen as much as they possibly can. It's just the finances don't work out that well, and theaters need to be paid a certain percentage if they want to keep their doors open right now. And so I just think that it makes sense for Apple to put this in theaters before going on Apple TV Plus. And I'm excited to see this when it hits in October. I'm very excited to see if this is kind of the beginning of seeing this trend continue, where you're putting these streamer films in theaters first and then going to a streaming service later. So it kind of, it becomes that kind of next class where it goes from a theater to a streaming service, to VOD, to DVD. That's the way that I think it should be in terms of the ladder for where it's going right now. And I'm really excited about where it could potentially go down the line. So what do you guys think about Killers of the Flower Moon's release date being October 6th to October 20th? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And then speaking of the Cannes Film Festival, it was also reported this week, kind of the no surprise, it was rumored for a little while, but it seems like it hasn't been confirmed, but it's solidly reported that Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, the fifth film and potentially final film in the Indiana Jones franchise, will be making its way to the Croissant in France, and it will be debuting at the Cannes Film Festival. It will reportedly either be debuting on either the second or third day of the festival, and this is very much coming off the heels of films like Top Gun Maverick, Elvis making their debuts at the film festival and kind of showcasing it to the world before those films were released for everyone to see in theaters. And it seems like Disney and Lucasfilm had the same idea for Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. Now, when you hear this news, I think the big question, whenever you hear a film debuting long before the film comes out in theaters, it potentially shows a big gain in confidence. Just a few weeks ago, it was reported that The Flash from DC Warner Brothers, which is their kind of big summer film of this year, is going to be making its way over to CinemaCon in just a few weeks and will be screened for the first time for a lot of people to see, to review and talk about, months before it's set to debut in theaters. And the same thing is happening for Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, where it's going to be really about a month and a half before it really hits theaters for everyone to see. So Disney and Lucasfilm have a lot of confidence in this movie, as they should, because I do think that the people working on this film are making something really, really so good and surprising. And I'm really excited to see where this film is going to go. I really like the trailer, and I know people have had their doubts about this film, and it's understandable because people were burned by Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. But I do think that while Spielberg is not working on this film, I think if you could have gotten anybody that wasn't a huge downgrade and is kind of not really losing anybody, you're kind of keeping that same level of greatness, is James Mangold. I think he's somebody who is just an exceptional filmmaker. The last two films that he has done are two of my favorite films in the years that they've come out. Logan was my favorite film in 2017, and Ford vs. Ferrari was one of my favorite films of 2019. Actually, it was my second favorite film of 2019. Right ahead of it was only Avengers Endgame. So it was an an amazing film, and I think he'll be able to inject the magic of that film franchise back into it while making it his own. And if anything, he knows how to close chapters of iconic characters. He did it with Hugh Jackman in Wolverine, even though Hugh Jackman's coming back for Deadpool 3. But in terms of the story at the time, that was the last time we were ever going to see Hugh Jackman play an iconic role that made him the star that he is today. And so I just think that the way that he was able to handle all that, make a different kind of superhero film that's if not the greatest comic book films of all time. It's number two for me. Right above it is The Dark Knight. Is the Dark Knight. And so I'm really excited to see what he can do with another iconic character and maybe try to get him into the sunset, whether it means killing him off or whether that means he lives and lives to see another day. We'll have to wait and see for the movie, but I really do like the person behind the camera and then everyone in front of the camera, along with Harrison Ford. We have Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who I'm really excited to see in this movie, who I think is going to really flex some muscles, no pun intended, in the action sequences and the dramatic sequences, and also bring her kind of levity as a comedic actress to the forefront in this and be a really good foil for Harrison Ford, and I can't wait to see their chemistry together. Mads Mikkelsen as the villain is going to be great. Boyd Holbrook, who is a James Mangold stan, is somebody who's worked with him for a long time. He's going to be in this film. So there's a lot of great aspects to this one that I'm really looking forward to. And the fact that it's hitting Cannes, again, even though Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of Crystal Skull did hit the croissant as well, and we all know the reviews that came out for that one, I do feel like if Disney and Lucasfilm did not think that they had the goods for this one, it would not debut at Cannes. And I think they know that they think they have the goods. It's going to be up to the public and to the people who see the film to judge that for themselves. But I think when you have somebody like a Harrison Ford, who you don't know how long you're going to see him go out to a venue like that, since he's up there in his age, but you want to celebrate him. You want to celebrate an iconic cinema character in Indiana Jones and an iconic cinema actor in Harrison Ford who portrayed him. It's kind of like that Tom Cruise scenario where you want the biggest stars there, and it really, before there was Tom Cruise, there was somebody like a Harrison Ford. And so it's really kind of celebrating somebody along those kinds of lines, a big legendary name like that, who sure didn't get the accolades when he was really in the prime of his career, but he was somebody that really was a chameleon when it came to these kind of big budgeted temples, whether it was playing Han Solo, whether it was playing a character like an Indiana Jones, or playing for a version of Jack Ryan, or playing the president in Air Force One, or playing the fugitive in The Fugitive. He was able to just kind of be all these different people. And even though you remember from playing Indiana Jones and Harrison and Han Solo, you remember from all these different roles as well. And so that's why he was just so big back in the 80s and the 90s more specifically, and was just one of those actors that you just always wanted to see him do what he did. And I think it's going to be very cool to see him once again in this. I'm excited to see kind of the de-aging technology that is at play here, where it seems like they're really pushing to have a young Indiana Jones in this film in some capacity, whether it's just for the first scene or whether we're going to see more of that as the film progresses is going to be interesting. But I'm very, very excited to see where this film goes. And I think having its first destination on its tour to releasing the film come from Cannes is a smart move. And we'll see what it does. But I think they're very much hoping for the Top Gun Maverick Elvis playbook here. And I'm very, very curious to see what the response of this film is going to be. Hopefully it's good. I have my fingers crossed. And James Mangold, I trust. And then I'm also curious to see what the finances are going to be for this film. Is it really going to be a huge film? Are people still interested in seeing another Indiana Jones film? I just think these are a lot of questions that come into the rear view here. And I think one of the questions was answered that Disney and Lucasfilm have enough confidence that they feel like they can go to the Cannes Film Festival and wow the crowd there and come out with some really glowing reviews. Because if you don't come out with glowing reviews, especially from Cannes, even though you have Venice and New York and Toronto, Telluride, some of those films that are potential Oscar prospects, and I'm not saying Indiana Jones is, but sometimes they just crash and burn, and studios are hoping that they have the goods, they want the response, but sometimes it just doesn't work out that way. And I'm sure Disney is hoping for more of the positives than potentially the negatives if it does come to that, if Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny does not live up to those expectations. But again, in James Mangold, I trust, and I'm hoping for this to be a really, really good film when it comes out on June 30th. What do you guys think about Indiana Jones heading to the Cannes Film Festival? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And then moving on to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, there's some casting news on a few fronts that I want to get into on the podcast today. The first one comes in a little bit of a shock, but not totally when you think about what this film is going to entail, and that is the return of Liv Tyler as the one and only Betty Ross in Captain America: A New World Order, which will be the fourth installment in the Captain America franchise in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And for Liv Tyler, this will be her first time reprising the role of Betty Ross since the 2008 film that came out almost 15 or so years ago in The Incredible Hulk, when Edward Norton was still the star of that film. It was before Mark Ruffalo even came onto the scene with the first Avengers film. So Marvel right now is keeping up with the casting line of kind of bringing back people who were gone for a little bit in some of these MCU installments but are now coming back in a different kind of a way. And Liv Tyler is one of those examples, and she will be reuniting with somebody else who is kind of returning for the first time since that 2008 film, and that is going to be Tim Blake Nelson. And I'm really excited to see what he's going to be bringing to the table. And then, of course, even though the original actor passed away about a year or so ago in William Hurt, Harrison Ford is going to be reprising the role of General Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross. And so we're going to be having Thunderbolt Ross in this one. We're going to be having Tim Blake Nelson back. We're going to be having Betty back with Liv Tyler. And there's been rumors of the fact that She-Hulk could, again, this is just rumors, but could potentially be coming to A New World Order as well. It seems like you might as well take out New World Order and call it Captain America: The Return or The Reunion of the Incredible Hulk cast at this point. And again, I'm really happy to see Liv Tyler back. And if you want any more confirmation, there are set photos taking place, it seems like, the cemetery for the film right now. And you very much see there are a few photos of Liv Tyler on set recording scenes, basically. So it seems like, even without saying it, she is going to be in this film in some kind of a capacity, one way or the other. And so I'm really happy to see these characters kind of come back. I was always wondering if we would ever actually get them. We did get one of them in Tim Roth when he came back for the Abomination in the She-Hulk. And so it seems like right now those areas of the MCU between the Captain America universe, the Hulk slash Incredible Hulk slash She-Hulk universe are kind of slowly diverging and coming together for this movie. And I'm really hoping that my one worry for me in this one, if there's any worry, is the fact that I'm hoping that this doesn't become a very much a Hulk-centric storyline, and that it very much focuses on Captain America, and kind of like what Thor Ragnarok did a little bit, where we have the Hulk a little bit, but the main focus is still on Thor. And I'm hoping that is exactly the case with this movie. And there's going to be a whole new director, there's going to be a whole new screenwriter team, so it's not going to be Marcus and McFeely that are writing the screenplay for these Captain America movies like they did with Winter Soldier, Civil War, along with Avengers Endgame and Infinity War. They're not going to have that anymore. And then you're also not going to have the Russo brothers. And you're just hoping that the writers, the director for this one, are able to do what those guys were able to do so well, which, especially in Civil War, where you're able to balance all these characters together but still make it a story in the world of Captain America, really, where a lot of the actions happen because of the characters from that franchise. And so I'm hoping that while we have all these characters coming in, it's going back to make sure that the center of it's still around now Sam Wilson and not Steve Rogers, and more so Anthony Mackie's Captain America in the future of the MCU. So I'm hoping that's where we're going with this one right now. That's my only concern, is that are we leaning too much into these Hulk dynamics and bringing these characters back and not focusing on the bigger picture? But again, I trust Marvel Studios. I trust these guys right now. I think they did a really good job of creating Falcon and the Winter Soldier. It seems like they're going to be continuing that story moving forward with this film. So I'm really, really excited about it. But at the same time, I'm still excited about it. But in the back of my mind, I'm still thinking about, could this be adding a little bit too much potentially? We'll find out. But again, I'm really happy to see Liv Tyler back in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, though. I think she played a really good Betty Ross, and it's going to be really interesting to see where she has been and what she has been doing for the last, like, 18 years, almost 30 plus movies at this point since the first film came out, which was the second installment overall in the MCU. It's going to be very curious to see where it goes and where her character goes and what she's been up to all this time, especially with Hulk and Banner running around. I'm very fascinated to see what they're able to do with that character. And then the other bit of Marvel news that came out this week was the announcement, speaking of Succession, to Matthew McFadden. It was reported by Deadline that Matthew McFadden, Tom Wimes-Gams himself, will be joining the cast of the one and only Deadpool 3. And according to reports, his character is still undisclosed at this point, but apparently, according to a report from the Hollywood Reporter, is that McFadden's character is going to be somewhat of a potential third wheel between Wolverine and Deadpool. So it seems like, at least right now, just from going off the little description that we got from the reports, it seems like he's going to be on the side of Deadpool and Wolverine and not the side of bad guys, in a way, for Matthew McFadden's character. And when looking at this casting, I think it is awesome casting. One for Matthew McFadden, who is going to be able to build off of the hype from Succession when it ends. And he's going to be allowed to probably do whatever he wants, really. Whatever comes his way. A lot of scripts, I feel like, are going to be thrown his way. And he decided to join the Deadpool franchise. And I think it's perfect for him. I think it fits what he's been able to do on Succession, which is kind of blend in that comedic line, but also towing it in enough where it's still, you can still make a dramatic impact in your characters and in your story. And so I think that is potentially the type of character that he is potentially going to be playing in this film. And I'm excited to see that. I'm excited to see the potential chemistry between him, Hugh Jackman, Ryan Reynolds. It's going to be really, really kind of fun to see that. And I'm going to be very curious to see where they go from here with this film. But I'm really excited to see that Matthew McFadden is joining the Deadpool 3 family. What do you guys think about this casting news for the Marvel Cinematic Universe when it comes to Liv Tyler? What do you think about that? And when it comes to Matthew McFadden for Deadpool 3, what do you think about that casting news? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And the final bit of news that I want to talk about on the podcast today is to go into the trending trailer portion of the Sam Bissell podcast. And the first trailer that I want to talk about right now is the first full trailer, really, for the next Pixar Animation Studios film coming out in theaters, fully in theaters, not a Disney Plus, not VOD, not Disney Plus Premier Access, just straight fully in theaters, is the new Pixar film Elemental, which is directed by Peter Sohn, and it stars an awesome cast that includes Lea Lewis, Mahumbo Atti, Ronnie Del Carmen, Wendy McClendon Convoy, and Catherine O'Hara are just some of the voice names that are going to be in this film. And I'm somebody who really does enjoy the Pixar films that have come out. Even last year, I thought Lightyear, as it was called, was fine. It was a fun, enjoyable film, not on the mantle of those great, incredible Pixar movies, but still enjoyable in what it was able to do. Some of the other films that have come out, Turning Red, Soul, especially with Soul, a phenomenal movie, one of my favorites when it came out during the pandemic, specifically 2020. But for Pixar, they've been a little bit of a rough patch, especially last year. Even though I enjoyed Lightyear, didn't do well critically. There was a lot of quote-unquote controversy behind the film. And so the question kind of has become, since there was no secondary Pixar film last year, the question this year kind of becomes, can this film be a little bit of a rebound for Pixar, in a way? And I think when it comes to Elemental and the way that it looks, I think it's a resounding yes. And what I've really enjoyed about this film so far and seeing the trailer is that it has that Pixar magic that we've come to see from films like an Inside Out, where it's dealing in a high concept, but is making sure that that parents, kids can experience it and have just as much fun as anybody else really does. And so seeing this trailer and seeing the fact that it's going to be dealing with elements of fire and water and wind and the earth, specifically kind of plants, basically, I found that to be very, very interesting. And I'm very curious to see where this film could go and what it could do for Pixar, because, again, they've been hit with multiple films being put on Disney+. Lightyear was not a big box office sensation and didn't do well. Even critically, it was, even though I enjoyed it, still did kind of so-so in the critics rating. So people were not turned on by Lightyear, no matter for what reason it was. Whether you agree with it, disagree with it, it did not do well for a reason. And so I think having a film like this is exactly what Pixar needs to get back into the swing of things. The big question for me kind of becomes, and I never thought I'd say this about a Pixar film, but because of the month of June, and very much June this summer feels exactly like what March has been so far, where literally almost every single weekend is going to be a new high-profile film coming out. So we have Elemental coming out on June 16th. Starting off in just the first day or two of the new month of the year in June is going to be Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, which is going to be hitting theaters on June 2nd. And then coming in next on June 9th is going to be Transformers Rise of the Beast. Coming out June 16th is going to be The Flash, which is the same day that Elemental comes out. So it's going to have major competition for getting families into theaters for that film when you have another bigger, high-profile film coming out the same day as you do. And then you also, of course, have a few weeks later, another big film from the same overall company in Disney with Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. So it's a really kind of sticky situation that Pixar finds itself in right now, where you kind of have to go in and see, is this a film that people want to go see? And are they going to go want to see it? Or is this going to kind of be in some way a kind of Shazam thing where there's just so many things coming out that people are just going to value other films more than others? And I'm hoping that Elemental doesn't become that kind of a film, because I do think that this is going to be an exciting film. A film that will really, really get people hyped up about seeing Pixar and their original concepts. Once again, the animation looks amazing. And so I'm hoping that this film is able to do well when it comes out on June 30th. What do you guys think about the trending trailer for Elemental? Did you enjoy it? Did you not enjoy it? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And the final thing that I want to end the podcast on today is talking a little bit about the one and only Wes Craven, and specifically his brand new film that is set to hit theaters this summer as well. Another one that's hitting on June 16th. So that's going to be a huge day for movie fans overall. Asteroid City will be hitting theaters on June 16th. Again, once again, directed and written by Wes Craven, who is one of the most revered auteur directors of our time. And the way that he's been able to just make different unique films and the style that he's able to do them in is just unprecedented and has never been repeated anyway, as far as I've been able to see. And just what he's been able to do with a lot of these awesome stories has been incredible, from his cinematography to the production design, set design, the actors. Everyone just knows what they are supposed to be doing when it comes to these films. And then along with having such a talented director, talented crew, he also has the A-list of the A-list cast members involved with almost each and every single one of his films. And this one is no exception whatsoever, as the film includes members such as Jason Schwartzman, Scarlett Johansson, Tom Hanks, Jeffrey Wright, Tilda Swinton, Bryan Cranston, Edward Norton, Adrian Brody, Liev Schreiber, Hope Davis, Stephen Park, Rupert Friend, Maya Hawke, Steve Carell, Matt Dillon, Hong Chau, William Dafoe, Margot Robbie, Tony Revelli, and Jake Ryan. So that's just what was on the poster and what was in the casting sheet. So for me, I'm very, very excited to see where this is going to be going and the style that he's approaching this one. And this one has a little bit of a unique style for Wes Craven, as it's very much more poppy and flashy. It's got a lot of lights and colors going for it, where, well, a lot of Wes Craven's films have color in them. This one just has this kind of glossy, poppy color hue to it that I'm really kind of digging, and I'm really excited to see where this one kind of goes. To kind of give a little bit of a synopsis, it basically, Asteroid City is about a time and place in 1955 in which students and parents from across the country gather for a scholarly completion, rest, recreation, comedy, drama, and a romance of a junior stargazer convention held in a fictional American desert town. So again, I think this is going to be a really fun and enjoyable film, and I'm somebody who really likes Wes Craven. I'm not the biggest Wes Craven fan of the world. However, I am somebody who is very much looking forward to seeing this film when it does come out. And I like the concept. I like the cast that's involved. The crew members I feel really bad for, so I might go and support it as well, because I just feel like, you know, you don't know where these movies are going to be kind of going. So I'm going to support it for the crew. I'm going to support it for the director. And it takes a lot to make these movies. And I'm really excited to see what they do with this film. It comes out again June 16th, probably primed up for the Cannes Film Festival most likely. And I wouldn't be surprised if this does make the jump to a potential award season run as well, because the Academy is also somebody that loves what Wes Craven does as well. So what do you guys think about these two trailers? Let me know what you think down below and leave your thoughts. And with that down and out of the way, that will do it for this edition of the Sam Bissell Podcast. Once again, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to check out my channel for more content. And check me out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Radio Public, SoundCloud, and much more. Also, make sure to tune in on to the Ambiguous Podcast Solutions. And be sure to check out the other amazing shows that are on here, such as You Mad Bro, the number one source to see what the internet is pissed off about on a weekly basis. Also, make sure to check out Goal-Driven Professionals, geared toward improving client relations, return on investment, and customer acquisition costs for independent businesses and services. Also, make sure to check out The Daily Grind, a weekly motivational podcast with Kelly Johnson, giving you everyday tips and key takeaways on reaching your goals. Also, along the way, make sure to check out these other amazing shows on the Podcast Solutions, such as Wrestle Attic Radio, WrestleMania Podcast, and Midnight Showing. You can check these out and so much more on the website, ambiguouspodcastsolutions.com, also on Facebook and Twitter at RealAmbiguous. And if you want to check out Canopy Treehouse, use the coupon code AMBIGUOUS. Also, when you get a chance, make sure to follow me on social media. Find me on Twitter at Bissell Samuel. That's BUSSELLSAMUEL. And also on Facebook at Sam Bissell. Once again, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. And until next time, keep on screening.